Do you like me too?
Oh, of course. You are a ravishing young woman.
I like you too.
Oh, that would make things quite exciting, I think.
What are you going to do? Turn me on?
I certainly try.
Welcome once again to Rampage on the Airwaves. You are listening to Sex Lies and CHIJ Girls by The Moderates in the background there. And today we have The History of Local Music Part 2 with Leonard Susay, who, if you need another introduction to him, is probably Singapore's most prominent local indie music producer. And on today's show, Leonard has picked some really important local bands of the late 90s to early 2000s. Starting off with Force Vomit, who were very, very prominent local surf punk band back in the late 90s, and they are actually still active today and still playing the same old music. The lineup's changed quite a bit over the past couple of years, but generally, the band's been kept together by Dino Vomit, who sings and plays the guitar and is the principal songwriter. And Leonard shared his thoughts with me on why he thinks Force Vomit is such an important local band.
They write songs about Singapore. You know, they write songs about our history, about our culture, about things that happened in Singapore, about, you know, Monaco, about A Girl Called City, and also, you know, about spacemen who fly over Malaysia. I guess that's my favorite Force Vomit song. I think it's one of the, you know, one of the most important songs that Singapore has ever produced, because it came out at a time when, you know, like, there were so many bands around that were like metal and grunge and, you know, the Brit indie scene. But Force Vomit was, you know, just trying to do music that represented Singapore.
Bearing in mind that a concept like that is still quite alien in the scene today, you can probably imagine how difficult it was for Force Vomit to actually gain some sort of acceptance within the local music scene when they first came out. I gotta admit, the first time I heard Force Vomit live, I was like, what the hell music are these guys playing, man? It's like some sort of twisted Malay wedding style. But they just eventually started winning over more and more fans because they stuck to what they were doing, and what they were doing was something completely unique and Singaporean. And it was such a refreshing change because the climate of the scene at that time was really divided into three distinct sides.
Singapore bands were trying to play like Pantera and Sepultura, and, you know, all the eras and all that. And then you have bands that were, you know, playing like Blur and Suede, and you also had bands that you know, were trying to sound like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Stone Temple Pilots. Because even, as far as Singapore is concerned, I mean, the underground scene was divided into three different groups. And, you know, like, the three groups never integrated or never, you know, like, got together. And through this scene, through that period, a lot of our now very popular bands actually came up from that underground scene. You know, bands like Lunarin nowadays, I mean, they used to be called Fuzzbox, and, you know, they were from the grunge scene. And Astral, which is, you know, very popular also, used to come from, you know, the Brit indie scene. In Force Vomit's case, they stuck more to the dangdut, you know, Malay kind of style. I mean, even their chord structures and, you know, their guitar riffs and all, you know, they were very, very traditional Malay music.
This unique sound even got the attention of the legendary BBC DJ John Peel, for whom we celebrated his death anniversary, I think, last week only. It was very, very telling of the fact that we had so many local bands around at that time who you could argue were a lot more polished, a lot more technically proficient, but the whole uniqueness and charm and the spirit of Force Vomit appealed to John Peel more than any other Singapore band.
John Peel didn't choose a band from the Singapore underground metal scene or the indie scene or, you know, the grunge scene. John Peel chose a band who he thought, you know, best represented Singapore, and he chose Force Vomit, and he featured them on his world famous show on the BBC. So the entire world heard, you know, Singapore music, and the entire world heard Force Vomit. 10 years down the road or 20 years down the road, you know, if someone came up to me and said, like, do you have a local band to recommend, that something that really sounded local, I would probably recommend Force Vomit.
We'll be right back. Forced Vomit, definitely one of the most important bands in the history of local music. They are still active. You can check them out at www.forcevomit.com. And they're actually performing on the Surya channel on 22nd of October, this Sunday, 10 a.m. So if you're awake at that time, check them out, man. Moving on to the other extreme of the musical scale, our legendary black metal band Impiety. I can't confess to know too much about them because I've only seen them, I think, once or twice live ever. Amazing band, but I think Leonard would be more qualified to speak about them.
Impiety is one of those bands that I'll remember for the rest of my life, not because of the kind of music that they were playing or the, you know, who they were, but it was more because, you know, we were going through very difficult times in our life. I mean, both me and Arifin, the lead singer and bassist of Impiety, because both of us actually had dads who were in the hospital who were going through major heart surgery. And it was really funny because, you know, we'd go to the hospital, like and, you know, be all holy and clean and all that. And then after that, you know, go back to the studio and start recording. And Impiety is a satanic band. So, you know, there was this conflict of good versus evil. You know, like, I mean, going to the hospital and then going to church and praying and then going back to the studio and, like, doing satanic music. Even though, you know, they play the kind of music that I don't listen to, they were actually kings of the local underground black metal scene. If I told you this fact, you'd probably laugh. But, you know, they're the only band that has outsold every Singapore band. Imagine that a black metal band or satanic band has outsold Electrico, Ronin, combined. Because they sold 40,000 copies of their record, which, you know, is very unheard of, even up to today. They were huge. They were a huge band overseas. But a lot of people didn't know that they were a Singapore band.
In actual fact, according to my latest research, Impiety can barely be considered a local band anymore because I think two of the founding members have left and they've been replaced by a couple of veterans from the Mexican metal scene. But there you have it. At the very least, there's no doubt they were a Singapore band, and Leonard also spoke about his experiences in recording them.
I had a lot of problems recording them at first. It was very difficult for me to, you know, go home and sleep at night and saying a prayer before I slept because of my dad. And then, you know, like, going back the next day and, you know, like, listening to music about Satan. So, you know, it's quite hard on me, lah. But the band convinced me, because even before we started recording, I mean, we sat down and we had a long conversation about religion and faith, and, you know, they convinced me that, you know, the music that they were playing was just music. You know, it didn't represent what they were or who they were or what they were doing, because, you know, they weren't going around burning churches or, you know, like, killing Christians or anything. If you look at the sleeve of the CD, I mean, I told them don't put my name, lah. I mean, do something else to make it more stylo. So they changed my name to Drenoel Yasus, which is Leonard to say backwards. And Drenoel Yasus sounds satanic, actually.
To me, the whole concept of projecting a certain kind of image, whether it's, you know, satanic or evil or sexy or childish or whatever, is tricky thing to work around, because, you know, people can say, oh, you know, you're just acting like that just so you can make money and sell records and that kind of thing. And then on the other hand, you've got people who go look at a band that has a certain image and go, whoa, they're fucking cool, you know. In Impiety's case, I think it's such a hard judgment to make because of the extreme nature of the music itself. Like, it would be unreasonable to expect them to, say, for example, carry a bloody battle axe into the office and, you know, oh, what are you having for lunch? Oh, I'm eating this bloody bird alive. So that's obviously not something that would be acceptable in most developed countries, you think. But anyway, this is what Leonard had to say about the whole image thing.
I mean, on stage and all, of course, yeah, like, very super Satan. They have, like, flame-throwing and, you know, like, they wear spikes and spears, and some of them even carry, like, battle axes on stage. It's the image of being fierce, of evil, or being very against Christianity and all that. But after the gigs and all, we usually go out and have a cup of coffee, or, you know, we go and have a prata or what. I mean, it's the normal things that, you know, normal people do. And then
it's a very well-guarded image. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's an image.
Like, associate with, like, say, Marilyn Manson.
Yeah, he's not, lah. I mean, I've watched MTV Cribs before, and Marilyn Manson was on, and, you know, he had this persona, and he was acting all fierce, and he was acting all evil and all that. And then his mom calls, you know, and then he picks up the phone and his mom starts shouting at him like, Sonny, I saw you that day on TV. Why were you wearing that? And he was like, oh, sorry, mom. Come on, mom, please understand. I mean, you know, it's the kind of things that happen to a lot of these rock stars, pop stars or whatever, because, you know, they have an image to uphold. And it's the image that actually sells them and sells the music. And it's the same with impiety also because, you know, it's the image of evilness. I mean, it's the image of Satan. But that's only to sell the music. It's not what they are because they're just normal human beings and nice people.
Which leads me to shed light on a very, very infamous incident that happened at an impiety gig some years back. And I asked Leonard, who was a witness to the event, to actually describe what happened.
Impiety played at Fire Disco, and I was the soundman at this black metal gig. And all the bands there were actually satanic bands. And I remember when Impiety came on stage, Arifin wanted to blow flame out of his mouth. So he had fuel in his mouth, and you know, he lit this torch. And he started blowing the flames, and everyone was screaming in delight, like, you know, all the fans and all jumping and all that. But the flame actually followed the fuel back into his mouth and burned his face. So he was actually burning on stage. His face was burning on stage. And there was a roar from the crowd because everyone thought it was a damn cool stunt. Maybe it was Satan coming to life. But, you know, the gig stopped then because Arifin needed some medical attention. But I thought it was, like, really funny because here were people that were cheering for their idol. But, you know, their idol was being burnt on stage.
It's actually become like an urban legend.
Yeah, it's urban legend because, you know, this story has been going around and, you know, like people come and tell me, like, hey, have you heard? Yeah, you know, I'll probably tell them, yeah, I was there, you know, I saw it happen. The irony of it was that, you know, it was fire that stopped a fire gig.
Yeah!
very brutal stuff indeed from Impiety, and let us not forget they are Singapore's highest selling band, even though most of their 40,000 record sales were done outside of Singapore. Still, you gotta give it to them. Up next is a very, very talented and innovative band that I feel never got the recognition they deserved because they came out at a time when local music was going through a really bad period of public disinterest. I am talking about Return to Fall, one of Leonard's favourite bands and one of the first few bands to record at his new Snakeweed Studios. And Leonard spoke about recording Return to Fall in what was a really tough time for him and the band.
Return to Fall is one of my favourite bands of all time. Recording them was really, really an experience. I mean, I learned so much during that period. It took about a year to record the whole album, another year for pre-production. Because when they first approached me, Amran said that he was going to record, but give him a year. And I said, like, you don't come to me and book the studio 1 year in advance. And he said, no, 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 give me a year. I'll come back one day and I'll show you my band. I really thought he was joking, but he got together a group of musicians and they were all people from NUS because, you know, he was in NUS at the time. The lead singer, he's actually from Sweden and he's a foreign exchange student. I guess he's the first royal blood that I've worked with. Because he's actually a baron in Sweden. You know, he comes from a royal family. Yeah. I was quite apprehensive at first because I never heard anything that they came out with. I only knew Amran and Sham from Plain Sunset. When we started pre-production, just before recording the album, you know, I mean, I heard the songs and I thought, like, what genre is this? I mean, never heard anything like this before. And then they said that it was sad, emotional music. So at that time, I mean, emo wasn't, like, very big or what, lah. I mean, and then they said that, you know, it was something that was very big in the underground, you know, it was growing. And they said that, you know, they listened to, like, Get Up Kids and the early emo bands. And, I mean, not like the emo bands nowadays, lah, because the emo bands nowadays are all, you know, manufactured. There's a certain kind of sound, but it doesn't represent exactly what emo means. They came to me at the right time also, because when we started recording, each of the band members was going through difficult times in their lives, you know, like breakup in relationship, stuff like that lah. And then for me also, I was going through a very difficult time in my life lah, which I don't want to say on Rampage because then people use that against me. But for those who know, I mean, I'm sure you know what I went through at the time. The whole recording process took a year. And when we started recording, it was the worst day of our depression. You know, first day of recording was the worst day of our depression. And then it just, you know, slowly got better, you know, after a while. And then, you know, the songs started developing themselves. And if you listen to the whole album, it tells a story. That means from song 1 to song 10, it tells a whole story. And it gets really sad and gets sadder and sadder and sadder. Until by the time you finish the CD, you'll probably be crying somewhere or, you know, remembering all your past issues and all your past problems and all that. But what is very important about this recording is that it represents what is popular now. But this was done like in the year 2001. So it took about 5 years for this kind of music to actually develop and to become popular. It just shows how far ahead or how advanced some of our Singapore musicians can be. They're not following a trend that's popular now, but, you know, they created that trend a long time ago. If you were to ask me, like, which band I wish would get back together and play gigs or do a recording again, I'd probably say Return to Fall. Touch my senses all along. Your lastness of kerosene, sway intense, I really know. But if you're scared, I'll take your life. Thank you.
there you have it, Return to Fall with Burn My Ticket. You can probably tell that that song is a prelude to the very, very popular music that you might call emo today. Incidentally, I do need to mention that this History of Local Music series that we've been doing for the last two shows, and we've got one more to go after this, really shouldn't be considered as the definitive history of, you know, everything Singapore has ever come up with musically. There's just too much music out there to be discovered, and too much for me to play in, you know, just 3 half-an-hour slots. And in any case, you know, I really don't want to be too self-indulgent in the past, because there's really a lot of excellent music that's, you know, local musicians are coming out with now that I don't want to neglect either. So if you do want to find out more about the music that you've heard on this show and the music that you haven't heard, I spoke to Leonard about it, and he did actually give quite a useful suggestion to find local music that may not be readily available in the shops.
Stores like HMV and all that, they don't stock all these CDs that are more than, say, a year old, because, you know, the minute they stop selling, the minute sales go down, you know, they rather use that space and, you know, sell the more popular artists like Paris Hilton or whoever lah. But I know that the library or the National Arts Council actually has an archive of everything that Singapore has produced. Yeah, because I think Patrick Cheng or Chang Kang, one of them, has been collecting all this stuff and archiving them in the National Arts Council library. So if you go down to the NAC or you go down to one of the libraries, I don't know if the Esplanade Library has it, but, you know, you could look at the archives of local music and you find like some of their old songs, old CDs and all that. I may not have everything, but at least, you know, someone has been archiving them.
Yeah.
So there you have it, something I didn't know either. And next time you're around the vicinity of the NAC, go and check it out. You never know what you might find. Anyway, moving on to the last song of The History of Local Music Part 2. It's a song by a band many would consider to be the most prominent indie band of the mid to late 90s. None other than Livonia, who had Daniel Sassoon playing guitar for them. Daniel, who is obviously the guitar player for Electrico nowadays. But before Electrico, he was part of Livonia, one of the first few bands to actually have a number one hit on radio. And that song was Vengeance Is Mine, the song I'm going to be playing for you. Even though Leonard did not produce that particular song for Livonia, he did eventually work with them on the follow-up album. And he spoke in detail about working with Electrico and how it was a really new experience for him. And with that, that's the end of the History of Local Music Part 2. I will see you in Part 3 very, very shortly. Enjoy! See ya!
Livonia was actually quite boring, lah. I mean, yeah, they were an indie band, but, you know, I had built my career doing metal bands and black metal bands and thrash and death. Then all of a sudden, you know, a band called Livonia approaches me and says, can we do a recording with you? Because Daniel Sassoon at that time, who was the, you know, the band member of Livonia, said, oh, I really like your sound. And he said that, you know, even though you've done metal and all that, you know, we want you to produce our album. And I was quite shocked, because I remember I used to go around that time at gigs and all that, and, you know, watch indie bands, and, you know, like, I'd cover my ears because, you know, I wasn't used to it. You know, it took me a while to get to accept indie music. But actually, when they first started playing songs to me and all that, I could grasp what they were trying to get at. And Daniel Sassoon was very highly, highly intelligent, you know, exposed me to a lot of indie music. I mean, a lot of bands that I've never heard before, and Dan's music knowledge is very, very extensive, and I started appreciating that kind of music. It wasn't the kind of music that I liked at that time, but, you know, it was because of Daniel that I started listening to a lot of indie bands and indie music. It was a very different experience, because when I was recording metal bands and all, I mean, the bands would always show up together. There was that brotherhood thing. Whereas in Livonia's case, it was different, because the drummer would come in by himself, and then, you know, the bassist would come in another day by himself, then Dan would come in by himself, and they'd all do their part separately. Then when the whole band got together, you know, there was a lot of conflict, there was a lot of, you know, arguments about the parts, about the songs. It wasn't as if the tension among the band members was bad, because it actually made them all better. The good thing that came out from Livonia was my relationship with a lot of the band members, because until today, they're still good friends of mine. You know, even though we don't sit together at the same table and have dinner, but, you know, I can have dinner with any one of them, and, you know, we still talk and laugh about the past. They don't bear grudges against each other or anything. I mean, they still laugh about the, you know, the issues that they used to argue about. Livonia will always be an important band, because they were one of the bands that actually pioneered that whole movement of radio. made Singapore music be cool.
Baby, I do what I like. You can force me to the things you want me to. There is nothing you can do. Say the things you want to hear. I'm so sorry I didn't make myself clear. There must be something wrong with you. So don't waste your time. Cause I just don't mind. I'm not gonna be like you. I will never be like you. I suggest you drink it and get away from me. Spare me from your philosophy. You may think I'm just wasting time, telling me I've made a mess of my life. Can't you see I'm doing fine? So don't waste your time. Cause I just don't mind. You will.